This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Not everybody likes to be scared at the movies, but for those who do, the late 60s through the early 80s was a golden age, with films like Night of the Living Dead, Rosemary's Baby, Halloween, Last House on the Left, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, A Nightmare on Elm Street, and Friday the 13th. My guest, Jason Zinnemann, is the author of the new book, Shock Value, How a Few Eccentric Outsiders Gave Us Nightmares, Conquered Hollywood, and Invented Modern Horror. Zinnemann is a critic and reporter who covers theater for the New York Times. We're going to talk about three films he says launched the modern horror film. Let's start with a relatively obscure one, the 1968 film Targets, which was directed by Peter Bogdanovich. Bogdanovich also co-stars in the film as a film director. In this scene, he's trying to convince an old, washed-up horror film star, Byron Orlock, to take a new role. But Orlock wants out of movies. Orlock is played by the real horror film star, Boris Karloff.
Everybody's dead. I feel like a dinosaur. Oh, I know how people think of me these days. Old-fashioned, outmoded.
Well, not after this picture, they wouldn't.
You can't change your whole lifetime with one picture.
What have you got if you quit?
Oh, Sammy, what's the use? Mr. Boogeyman, King of Blood, they used to call me. Marx Brothers make you laugh. Garbo makes you weep. Orlock makes you scream. And once I thought I'd be an actor. Oh, it's not that the films are bad. I've got bad. I couldn't even play a straight part decently anymore. I've been doing the other thing too long.
Of course you could.
And even that isn't the point. You know what they call my films today? Camp. High camp. Wait a minute, I want to show you something. My kind of horror isn't horror anymore. There we are. Look at that. No one's afraid of a painted monster.
That's Boris Karloff and Peter Bogdanovich from Bogdanovich's 1968 film Targets. Jason Zinnemann, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, you see this movie as a eulogy for the old horror film. Why?
Well, in the clip that you just heard, you get a sense of Peter Bogdanovich, who made this movie, his point of view about the horror film in 1968 when it's made. He didn't like horror. He didn't even like Dracula and Frankenstein. And he thought that in an era where you had all this political tumult and you had, you know, assassinations in the news, that these old Vincent Price and Boris Karloff movies were no longer scary. And when Roger Corman, who produced this movie, gave him the chance to do his first movie, it was under the condition that he use Boris Karloff in the movie. So this was a real problem for Bogdanovich, because he didn't think that Karloff was relevant anymore and wasn't frightening. So he came up with a pretty kind of ingenious solution, which was that he broke up the movie into two halves. One, which is Karloff playing a Karloff-like figure, an aging a horror star who no longer is very relevant, and who delivers this speech, which says that, you know, no one's afraid of a painted monster anymore. And then in the second narrative, he articulates, you know, what he thinks is truly scary, which I think anticipates the new school of horror.
And the real horror in Targets is a serial killer.
It's a serial killer, and it's essentially, you see this guy who is inspired by Charles Whitman, the sniper in Texas, and it's a very realistic, almost mundane portrait of him buying bullets to a gun, going about his daily life, seeing his family. We learn very little about his psychology or his motivation. And then he goes to the screening where the Karloff character, Byron Orlock, is introducing his movie, and he goes behind a screen and he starts shooting at people in a drive-in movie theater. The only thing we know about this guy in terms of what his motivation is we get one shot of him in Vietnam. So we know he's a Vietnam vet. And these movies in 68 have a kind of counterculture edge to it. But what I think is more important is the fact that is what we don't know. You know, I think what Bogdanovich is saying is that the real world, you know, sort of a realistic portrait that it allows for some uncertainty about what is evil and where it comes from, is much more frightening than the sort of old Victorian notion of horror, which has all these atmospherics, the spooky old houses, these kind of expressionistic lighting, which had become a little campy.
So are there other things that you think separate the modern horror film from the older horror films?
Yeah, I think, several things. I think that if you look at this period from 68 to the end of the 70s, generally, first of all, you see a lot more unhappy endings. There isn't this kind of catharsis at the end that you see in a lot of movies before that. The central kind of monsters are no longer werewolves and vampires and the supernatural. The central monsters are, or I guess I would say the central monsters become serial killers and zombies. And of course, there's still a lot of vampires in the 70s as well, but I think the most significant one is probably the serial killer. And I think the other thing that marks it is there's a certain kind of moral ambiguity about these movies, and just generally a sort of sense of confusion and disorientation that marks most of these films.
One of the films you write about is the 1968 film Night of the Living Dead, a zombie classic, directed by George Romero. Before we talk about it, let's hear the opening scene. And in this scene, a brother and sister have reluctantly driven a long way to their father's grave at their mother's request for their annual visit to lay a wreath on the grave. And the brother and sister have been quarreling in the car because he's grumbling about having to drive so far. He doesn't want to go. And she's annoyed with him. Meanwhile, it's a very bleak day. It's starting to thunder as they get to the cemetery. And once at the cemetery, the sister is kneeling at the grave in prayer. As the scene goes on, the brother tries to scare the sister because he knows she gets a little skittish in cemeteries. She gets really annoyed. And then he says, "Oh, look, who's coming now?" And it turns out the person coming now is a zombie. So let's go back to the beginning of the scene where it's starting to thunder and she's kneeling at the grave praying.
"Hey, come on, Barb. Church was this morning, huh?" "I mean, praying's for church, huh? Come on."
"I haven't seen you in church lately."
"Well, there's not much sense in my going to church. Do you remember one time when we were small, we were out here? It was from right over there. I jumped out at you from behind the tree, and Grandpa got all excited, and he shook his fist at me, and he said, 'Boy, you'll be damned to hell.' Remember that? Right over there. Well, you used to really be scared here."
"Johnny."
"Hey, you're still afraid."
"Stop it now. I mean it."
"They're coming to get you, Barbara."
"Stop it. You're ignorant."
"They're coming for you, Barbara."
"Stop it. You're acting like a child."
"They're coming for you. Look, there comes one of them now."
"He'll hear you."
"Here he comes now. I'm getting out of here."
"Johnny."
Once the zombie appears after trying to eat the sister, the brother grabs the zombie, and then the zombie starts eating the brother and kills the brother. The sister gets away but dies before the movie ends. It's a really incredible opening scene. It's very atmospheric. It's really spooky and, you know, very surprising the first time you see it. So how do you think George Romero's zombies, his now famous zombies, compared to all the zombies that preceded Night of the Living Dead?
Well, first off, every time I go to a cemetery, I think about the scene. I mean, this scene is just terrifying. and I mean, the impact, my day job is I'm a theater critic. And just last week, I reviewed a zombie Western, which had zombies which were like Romero's zombies. And today I got an email telling me there's a play which is Our Town with zombies, And I've seen a play called Twelfth Night of the Living Dead. It's you cannot imagine how influential this tiny little movie in Pittsburgh has been. And so these zombies, I mean, in the horror world, there's a huge, angry, polarized divide between people who love slow zombies and people who love fast zombies. And these are obviously the quintessential slow zombies. And, I mean, what you hear in that clip, I mean, it's great that you played this clip after Targets, because when he is doing the voice, the creepy voice of the old horror, that's a voice which is meant to evoke Karloff, who is one of the great voices in the history of movies, Karloff and Price. And
I mean, this is when he's saying, "They're coming to get you, Barbara."
Exactly. That kind of echoing voice. These movies in 68, the horror movie was really having a tough time in 1967. I mean, there weren't many horror movies that Hollywood was putting out that were successful. And so these movies are really grappling with what to do about the horror movie. And they all are kind of, you see in that movie, you know, again, Romero evokes the old horror, and then the new horror comes lurching towards us. And
well, you know, the new horror has so much more blood, guts, gore, intestines. I mean, one of the producers of the film was from the meatpacking industry, and he loaned a lot of innards for it.
he's a key figure in the history of horror. I mean, this was the movie that kind of made gore mainstream. It wasn't the first movie that included a lot of gore, but it used it incredibly effectively, and it became part of the kind of artistic palette of the horror movie. And there's a scene, probably the most memorable scene in the movie, is when a daughter who's a zombie eats her father, and it's messy. and since then, of course, movies have gotten more and more gory. But I mean, the interesting thing is that the intentions of George Romero were one thing, but how the movie was received was something else.
What was the difference between the two?
Well, a lot. But the key thing was that the main character of Night of the Living Dead, the hero, there was this sort of defiant hero who was an African-American actor played by an African-American named Dwayne Jones. And, at the end of the movie, you have this very strong African-American actor who at one point slaps a blonde woman and who faces off against all these zombies and is just a wonderful horror hero. And he gets gunned down by the law in this very ridiculous way after defeating all these zombies. It was viewed as a statement about civil rights and a kind of anti-authority statement. Now, the fact is that I talked to a lot of people who worked in this movie, and they said that this guy, the part was written for a white truck driver. And he just happened, they didn't have a lot of money, they didn't have a lot of good actors, and this guy auditioned, and he was the best guy for the job. He insisted, he sort of didn't want this his character to be a truck driver and to be kind of a gruff guy, and he played him with this great dignity. And it was sort of by accident. And a lot of these, I mean, one of the things I'm fascinated by these movies is how a lot of their greatest elements happen through a combination of, strong vision and happenstance and accident.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jason Zinnemann. He writes about theater for the New York Times. His new book is about modern horror films. It's called Shock Value. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jason Zinnemann. He writes about theater for the New York Times. His new book is about modern horror films. It's called Shock Value. So we've been talking about how there are three kind of turning point horror films from 1968. Peter Bogdanovich's Targets, which starred Boris Karloff, George Romero's Night of the Living Dead, and the third that you mentioned is Rosemary's Baby, which was a big commercial success in 1968. Roman Polanski directed it. It starred Mia Farrow as a pregnant woman who thinks there's maybe something wrong with her baby. She doesn't feel right. But her husband, her neighbor, her obstetrician all reassure her. Of course, it turns out they're all part of a devil-worshipping cult, and Rosemary has been impregnated with Satan's child. So let's hear a scene with her husband.
Guy?
Yeah.
I'm going to Dr. Hill Monday morning. Dr. Saperstein is either lying or he's, I don't know, out of his mind. Pain like this is a warning something's wrong.
Rosemary.
And I'm not drinking Minnie's drink anymore. I want vitamins in pills like everyone else. I haven't drunk it for the last 3 days. I've thrown it away.
You what?
I've made my own drink.
Is that what those bitches were giving you in there? Is that their hint for today?
They're my friends. Don't
They're
call
a bunch
them
of not very bright bitches who ought to mind their own damn business.
All they said was get a second opinion.
Rosemary, you got the best doctor in New York. You know who Dr. Hill is? He's a Charlie Nobody. That's who he is.
I'm tired of hearing how great Dr. Saperstein is.
Well, we'll have to pay Saperstein, we'll have to pay Hill. Well, it's out of the question.
No, I'm not changing. I just want to go to Dr. Hill and get a second opinion.
I won't let you do it, Rome. I mean, because it's not fair to Saperstein.
Not fair to... What are you talking about? What about what's fair to me?
Look, if you want a second opinion, you tell Saperstein... And let him decide.
No, I want Dr. Hill.
At least have that much courtesy to tell me as you feel. Ro? Rosemary? What is it?
Stop.
What?
Pain, stop. Stop that.
Stop.
Stop.
What was in that drink you made?
Eggs, milk, sugar.
What else? What else? Oh, Rosemary, for Christ's sakes, what else was in that drink?
It's alive. God, it's moving. It's alive. It's all right. Feel.
Oh, you have felt it.
Don't be scared, it won't bite.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's really...
I feel it kicking. It's alive. It's moving.
So that's a scene from Rosemary's Baby, which was released in 1968. My guest is Jason Zinnemann, the author of the new book about modern horror films called Shock Value. So how do you think Rosemary's Baby breaks from the past?
Well, Rosemary's Baby adopts this strategy that became very common, which was in the horror movie, which is to set up a very kind of normal, realistic, mundane landscape and then introduce the supernatural to get the audience to suspend its disbelief for a little bit. And, you know, I think what you see with Rosemary's Baby, what Polanski wanted to do was to really... And it's a little hard to see now because we've seen so many movies like this since then. But he really wanted to keep the audience guessing on whether or not Rosemary was crazy and imagining this, the fact that she was about to have the devil's child, or this was really happening. And he did it by shooting it, emphasizing how subjective the movie's point of view was. And that's the real suspense of the movie, which is, you know, is this really going on? It's this very paranoid movie. And I think you see it in, say, like Black Swan, you know, is one of the many movies today that uses a similar tactic.
Now, you point out that there's a decision that the filmmaker made to not show what the baby looked like, what Satan's child looked like. And in a more conventional film, you might have seen this like monstrous little creature. You don't.
Right, right. Because in Polanski's mind, this is a movie that really wanted to be more about suggestion and wanted to be in the mind of Rosemary. And that if you saw the monster, first of all, I find it hard to believe that whatever special effects they had at the time wouldn't date rather fast. So to not show it in this case was probably a smart move.
I want you to know that I recently interviewed Nick Palmgarten, a writer for The New Yorker, who wrote a piece about online dating. And he mm-hmm. says one of the people who works at one of the online dating sites told him that a good way to find your match is to answer the question, do you like horror movies? And if you answer yes and somebody else answers yes, it's an indication you're probably a good match. Now, I tell you this because I think your marriage might be in trouble because you mention at the end of your book that your wife doesn't really like horror movies. So I thought I owed it to you to warn you.
Trust me, I know. I know. It's on thin ice. I mean, I put this in the end of the book, but when I have a 2.5-year-old daughter And when my wife was, I don't know, 8.5 months pregnant, I was finishing up the book, and I was watching, you know, Alien over and over again, and The Brood, which are movies you really don't want to watch when you have a pregnant woman in the house. but I think my wife is at first sort of puzzled by how much I love these movies, but she's game. I mean, I think she actually likes them a little more than she used to, but no, they're definitely not her cup of tea at all.
Well, before we end, I want to apologize to any listeners who feel that their most loved or most despised horror film was not mentioned in our interview. But I will say there are many, many more films mentioned in your book, Shock Value, so they can find some more there. There was only so much time to get to so many movies. Jason Zinnemann, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure.
Jason Zinnemann's new book about the modern horror film is called Shock Value. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Zinnemann also writes about theater for the New York Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ray Romano has made a career of exploring the humor and the neuroses of his personal life. His latest series, TNT's Men of a Certain Age, which presents its second season finale tonight, is a drama with lots of comedy about a divorced man and his friends who are working their way through various sorts of middle-aged crises. Romano's previous TV series, Everybody Loves Raymond, was a hit sitcom about a married man with his own small but endless problems. Ray Romano won an Emmy for starring in Raymond, and this year won a Peabody as the co-creator with Mike Royce of Men of a Certain Age. Fresh Air TV critic David Bianculli spoke with Ray Romano. They started with a scene from Men of a Certain Age. In this scene, the three main characters are at a diner where they normally meet for breakfast to discuss anything and everything. Terry, played by Scott Bakula, is planning a trip to Palm Springs to get a colonoscopy, and he's trying to get his friends to come along and get the procedure, too. He knows what buttons to push. With Owen, played by Andre Brower, it's food. And with Joe, Ray Romano's character, it's golf.
Yeah, all right, I'm in. I'm in for your little weirdo weekend.
Great.
Good. You know what we should do? We should play golf out there. They got great courses out there.
Definitely. Yes. Yes.
Nope.
Oh, come on. After the procedures, we can go to that steakhouse in Palm Springs that you're always emailing us about. You know, the one that brings the skewers and meat right to your table.
Rinaldo's.
Yes, think about it. You can't eat anything for a whole day, right? Just imagine all that meat waiting for you.
All right, I'll go.
Of course you're going.
All right. We're going to be the three musketeers.
No, I'm not going if you're going to be making all these stupid ass jokes, okay? No puns. None of that nonsense.
There's going to be a lot of those.
Half the reason to go.
I'm excited.
That was Scott Bakula, Andre Brower, and our guest, Ray Romano, in a scene from last season's Men of a Certain Age. Ray Romano, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It must be fun playing these scenes, but it's so different than what you did on Raymond. So what do you lose and what do you gain by switching to drama rather than four camera? So there's no audience, there's multiple takes.
The only thing I miss from the sitcom format is that immediate gratification of if we're talking about comedy, of the live audience. And as a stand-up, I don't want to say former stand-up because I'm still a stand-up. you know, I live off of that. It's my energy source, so to speak. And there is none of that when you're doing a single camera.
You talk about the surprises and the energy that the audience gave you in a sitcom. How many surprises and how much energy do your co-stars give you in the filming this way? I mean, Andre Brower, for example, as far as I'm concerned, is an amazing dramatic actor, and I was stunned by how funny he can be in this. And the flip of that, which is a compliment to you, is how good you are as a dramatic actor acting opposite these guys. So what's that like from your perspective?
Well, as far as Andre being funny, that's an interesting thing because when we wrote it, we wrote the part for Wendell Pierce, and the character was this guy who had a little bit of the weight of the world on his shoulders and was overweight, a little bit overweight, had let himself go a little. He was a diabetic, and he was under his father's shadow, and he was kind of lost a little. And of course, we knew there was going to be comedy in it, and there were many times when Wendell Pierce, where there were some light, funny moments in The Wire. And Wendell met with us, by the way, and loved it, and was really almost ready to commit when the show Treme came up. And, you know, we totally understood when he said he had to go do that. He's from New Orleans. And
that's another David Simon show who did The Wire.
Right, yeah. Right. But he was very nice, and he had to politely decline. But somebody pitched Andre Brower, and, you know, our immediate reaction, I'm being totally honest, was no. Well, thanks, but no, it's not Andre Brower, because we pictured Homicide.
Yeah.
We pictured the guy coming in the room and just owning the room and this power. And we definitely didn't think he was overweight or anything, or let himself go a little. And then it's funny because the agent, being the agent, said, well, you know, I don't know if you've seen Andre lately, you know.
Yeah.
But so we agreed to meet with him for sure because he's Andre Brower. And he came. He flew across. He lives in Jersey. He flew to L.A. And we sat down. We had a meeting and we talked. And he loved the script. And he loved the idea of playing a character like this. So he left and we were very impressed. And then all we had to think of was, what about the comedy? Because there was really no comedy in that scene we did together. But and we searched the internet for Andre Brower being funny. And if you try to Google that, that's the only time Google has failed. He beat Google. He put in Andre Brower comedy, and Google has to shut down. But we just said, you know what, let's just go with the best actor in the room. And you know, I'm sure he could take a note if he pushes too hard. We'll talk to him. And we never had to say anything. You know, he briefly had a little comment because he was concerned about it. He was concerned about doing the comedy part of our show. Mm-hmm. And we just, you know, basically said something like, real, as you know, it's just all real. And he amazes me because we write it. We write it in the room. And we have we know the comedy rhythms where how something is funny and what and how it isn't. And we write it with this rhythm in mind. And, you know, there are a couple other former comedy writers in our room also. And we all say it out loud and we know exactly how this is going to be funny. And he says it just the opposite. and it's still funny. It's even funnier. He does it like an actor. And he comes with a built-in Emmy nomination. That's good. You know, Andre, he got nominated for the Emmy the first year. Thank God we would have got shut out.
Our guest is Ray Romano, co-star and co-creator of Men of a Certain Age, which concludes its latest season tonight on TNT. In looking up your bio stuff for this interview, one thing that I didn't know about you is that you initially studied to be an accountant. And I thought immediately of Bob Newhart, who was an accountant and then out of nowhere did stand up and got this huge career out of just having the nerve to go on stage for the first time when he made people laugh privately. So was Bob Newhart an influence on you?
Well, yes, not for the reason that he was an accountant and became a comedian, but by the way, when studied accounting is kind of
I often wonder about the things that I read. Okay, let's clear this up for
No, I mean I was always good in math, so when I was flailing around and not knowing what to do, I figured, well, I guess accounting is math, and I took maybe two semesters of accounting, like accounting 101 and accounting 102, and then I just dropped out of I practically dropped out of school, really. So I have some classes in accounting, but I don't know anything about accounting. I, you know, when my accountant tells me all the things he does, it's a foreign language to me. But my mother used to tell me exactly what you just said. You know, Bob Newhart was an accountant. She kept pushing that to try to keep me going. But
in
Bob
which
Newhart
direction?
Was...
In accountancy or in
No,
comedy?
In accounting, in school, yes, yeah. In school. And she would... you know, in my early days of stand-up, instead of saying stand-up, she would make sure she brought up that I was studying accounting instead of stand-up. but Bob Newhart was just an influence on me on his, I mean, I just loved his style, his subtlety. Him and Bill Cosby was a big influence on me.
Growing up, was it the comedy albums or the TV shows? What were your comedy influences?
Well, I will say my first comedy album, and probably, I guess I knew about stand-up, but I think it was my first big introduction to stand-up was a comedy album that a buddy of mine got, and he gave it to me, and it was an album. It was back in the days when it was a, you know, it was a record that spun around. It was Bill Cosby. It was To Russell, My Brother, Whom I Slept With.
Yes.
That was the name of the album, yes. And I was blown away by it. And then I ran to his house, and we listened to it together. And I'm not saying I tried to emulate him, but that's what appealed to me. This guy just talking, you know, it wasn't set up in punchline. It wasn't jokes. Those are fine. Rodney Dangerfield style was hysterical also, but this seemed more organic to me. This guy just talking about his brother and the father and this and that.
How'd you get the nerve to get into stand-up in the first place?
Saturday Night Live was starting. It was 1975 with Saturday Night Live.
Yep.
Was that right?
Yep.
Yeah.
That's when it started.
And it's like nothing we've ever seen. Saturday night with 18-year-olds, we stay in to watch it, and a group of us started our own little sketch troupe. These are like 5 17-year-olds. And we just joined together and we did it, and the kids all came in. And it was kind of my first taste of what stand-up was like. So that was kind of where maybe the bug of performing stand-up came. But it wasn't until I heard about the improv having audition nights. And I called up and they told me, well, it's every once a month we have audition night where you come down on Sunday afternoon and you pick a number out of a hat. And like there's usually like 50, 60 people there trying to get a number out of a hat, and they have 25 spots. So if you get a blank, you get nothing. If you have one of the numbers, you go on that night. And I went down and I took somebody with me, a girl with me, a friend of mine, to pick a number also so I'd have a better chance. And I told her, if you get the number and I don't, just tell him your name is Jackie Roberts. I made up a name that would be
androgynous.
Yeah, thank you. Androgynous. So she, of course, she got the number. I didn't. She tells him Jackie Roberts. So that night I go on as Jackie Roberts. I'm number 23 of the night. And I do well. And if you do well, she calls you back for the next month, and I got a call back, but I had to go on to Jackie Roberts. I wasn't about to tell her. So, and I got a call back again. So for the first 3 months of stand-up, I was Jackie Roberts until I gave it up then, because once you experience bombing, you realize how hard the business is, and it scared the hell out of me, and I gave it up for like 2 years. And when I went back 2 years later, I was Ray Romano. They didn't remember Jackie Roberts. So,
I'd like to go back to your post-stand-up sitcom career. We've played something from your drama. Now to play something from the sitcom for which you're acclaimed and famous, yes, and made a bunch of money. Everybody Loves Raymond ran for 9 years, mm-hmm, 1996 to 2005. And the clip that I'm going to play has you with your mom and dad, played by Doris Roberts and Peter Boyle. And I don't think I need to set up anything more than that. We can just run it.
Dad told Allie that I am going to hell.
Frank?
He never goes to mass, Marie. It's an open and shut case.
You see? You see, Bob?
No, you should go to mass, Raymond.
I don't want to go!
Why do you hurt me?
Look, I don't mean to hurt you,
Stop
Mom.
Stop hurting your mother. Go to church.
No!
Oh. Look what you're doing to her. Go to church.
No, no. I don't feel like it.
I don't feel like it. That's the problem with you kids today. Everything has to feel good. Do you think World War II felt good? Do you think Korea felt good? In my day, nothing felt good.
Why don't you go back to your day and stop ruining mine?
5 years of Catholic school down the toilet. Go to church!
Frank, you can't just scream at someone to go to church.
Well, 40 years of your guilt hasn't worked.
I need more time.
That's Peter Boyle, Doris Roberts, and our guest Ray Romano in a scene from Everybody Loves Raymond.
I know the title of that show. That was The Prodigal Son, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I know the how it ends up and all that. I mean, I remember the actual lines of the scene. It was just making me laugh.
What was it like bouncing off of them? I imagine you go from stand-up, you go into the sitcom, that you are learning in a university in pretty high stakes week by week with these guys.
I was scared, and I was coming off a not good experience of being fired from another sitcom, news radio. I was racked with insecurity, and then I remember when we were rehearsing our first episode, the pilot episode, and this is my show now, and this is a show built around me, and there's Peter Boyle, and I hadn't really talked to him that much, and I was his reputation just scared me. Who he was, you know, he was this hulking strong presence, and he was an actor, and during day one of rehearsal, in between one of the scenes, our paths crossed backstage, and he just stopped me, and to this day I remember him saying it, and it I remember it because it was, I don't even know what it meant, but it was such a gesture of his. He just stopped me and he goes, "It's just like water, just let it flow." And that was it. And I, you know, of course, I know what he meant. At that moment, I was just blown away that he would, you know, be this kind gesture of trying to make me feel comfortable. And then we became great friends after that. So we used to hang out. He used to take me out to dinner, and he would say, "Let's go to this place. There's a lot of celebrities there. You'll have fun to dinner." And we'd go to dinner, and he would be like the celebrity that everybody would be coming around. Yeah. But he was a great guy. He was a Renaissance guy. He knew everything. He could have a conversation about anything: politics, government, this, you know, art. And then with me, and that was the great thing about him, he would dumb it down with me. He'd talk about sports and Hooters, you know, with me. he was just a great guy. Yeah, and just the you know, I'm only saying this because he's the opposite of the character he portrayed on the TV, as far as that goes. Yeah.
We're discussing Peter Boyle, who played your dad on Everybody Loves Raymond. If this isn't too personal a question, your real dad died last year,
year and a half ago.
If it's okay for me to ask this, how your relationship with him changed over the years and was at the end, and I ask it mostly because you mine so much humor out of the father-son relationship on the sitcom as exaggeratedly played for comedy.
Yeah, well, my joke used to be about my father and Peter Boyle, that anything you see Peter Boyle do on TV, my father has done in real life without pants on. So, yeah. we would take what my father did and censor it down for the sitcom, and that's not to say, you know, our relationship was actually really good at the end, but growing up, he came from a family, his father left him when he was two or three, and came back into his life much when I was an adult. I remember visiting his father when he came back into the picture. So he grew up, you know, it wasn't the best of situations for him emotionally. And he was very undemonstrative. That's just the way he was. I knew he loved me, but we never heard it. He had a hard time saying it. I never heard him say my mother's first name. Lucy is my mother's name, and I've never heard him say that because that was too intimate for him. And this is how we grew up. And as a kid, I don't know. Look, I'm not going to make a big deal out of it, but you know, when you go to stand up, there seems to be a common denominator of some form of need or want for validation from the audience that maybe you were lacking as a kid or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
As I got older, he had a very dry sense of humor, though. I realized that this kind of is where I got it from, a super dry. And I've told this story before, but and we did it on the show. We did it in the pilot episode. He, in real life, he would drive my wife crazy in the smallest, subtlest way. He did, and the one thing he did was he learned how to play back our messages. You know, when we had answering machines that actually recorded and you had to push a button and play them back, he learned the code that you could call in and push, you know, beep, beep, and it would play back your messages. He learned our, I don't know how he looks. So he would listen to our messages and then leave a message after saying, you know, hey, Anna, your friend Linda went to the gynecologist today, you know, should check up on her. And he hang up, you know, and this was his little dry way, and he thought it was funny, and I thought it was funny. And my wife would go nuts and say, that's like reading our mail. What's he doing? And she's like, you have to talk to him. You have to talk to him. And I'd say, Dad, please don't do it. And he goes, I'm just whatever. I'm joking, you know. And I go, I know, it's not funny to her, though. And then he trumped himself. It was about a week later where he found out from an outside phone how to change the outgoing message. You can change your outgoing message when you're outside. If you hit a certain
wrong.
Beep, beep, beep.
Yeah.
Yes. And then we call up. My wife and I call from somewhere outside to listen to our machine. And instead of hearing me saying, hey, you've reached Ray and Anna, you hear my father's voice. You reached Ray and Anna. Yeah, they're not here now. You can leave a message. If you want me, Al Romano, I'm at 718-268, whatever. And, you know, it's funny on paper. On paper, it's funny. And my wife, I really think she started to cry. She almost started crying. And this was who he was. He was like kind of his way of connecting. It was his way when he wasn't, you know, bothered by something or angry and of showing any kind of affection, was just to do it through comedy. This silliness that we all got a kick out of and the women didn't. And then as we got, yeah. And then as we got to, you know, as I started doing stand-up and everything, and he got a big kick out of it. And then there's this bond we had through comedy. You know, I would kind of make him laugh and he would always make me laugh. And so we did connect as an adult. I had this connection with him that I never thought I would have as a kid.
We're talking with Ray Romano, co-creator and co-star of Men of a Certain Age, the TNT drama that presents its season finale tonight on the TNT cable network. Your character in Men of a Certain Age is a golfer with senior tour aspirations and gambling problems. And you, in real life, are a very good golfer. And for the last 4 years, I guess, unless it's five, you've competed in the World Series of Poker. How good are you at these sports?
Very not. that's what's great about acting. That's the most acting I'm doing out there is when I pretend to be a scratch golfer or a golfer who could make it on the senior tour. I don't know if you golf or not, but I have golfed.
I'm not a golfer.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm a 14 handicap. Anyone who golfs knows what that means. I shoot 90 to 100 or once in a while 85. And as poker, I you know, we have a monthly game we play, but I don't play a lot. I'm acting and CGI-ing a lot on the show. But it's fun. I mean, it's fun to pretend, you know. So, it is a fantasy of mine. It's always been a fantasy of mine.
So in the season finale, which I have seen, and I'm not spoiling anything, but there are many shots that are photographed at a long shot where you make some really nice chips and some really nice putts. And I was thinking either that was CGI or it's a different kind of money pressure putt because the money's on the line with production stuff. So did you sink those shots or did you?
Well, here's what it is. Here's what it is. It's for the putts. It's not that there's a different kind of money pressure. It's there's many opportunities to make it. It's putt, miss, do it again, putt, miss, do it again, cut. I will say this, though, if anyone watches, there is a chip in the there's a montage of me making shots.
Yes.
And there is a chip from off the green. and then it rolls about, I got to say, 30, 40 feet maybe into the cup. First take, first shot actually happened.
And the Peabody the same year.
Yeah. But otherwise, most of the time I'm swinging the club without the ball there because my swing without a ball there is much better than when you put the ball there. Golfers will know that once you put the ball down. Yeah. And then we CGI the ball. We CGI the ball going in the – this is for the long shots where we need it to go. I mean, I could make a good shot, but we don't have that much film or money to waste that time. Yeah.
I think all my illusions have just been destroyed.
Oh, no, don't say that.
Okay. All right, I won't say that.
It's not that I'm not a golfer. I'll still beat you in golf.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no doubt of that. I could score 100 maybe and then have to play the second nine.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, your season finale is tonight, and good luck to you. Ray Romano, thanks for being on Fresh Air.
Is that it?
That's pretty much it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Ray Romano spoke with Fresh Air TV critic David Bianculli. The season finale of Romano's series, Men of a Certain Age, is tonight on TNT. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.